The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There was a sense among the, you know, existing police that this was much more serious, right? I mean, one of the things that if we could go back in time, I think the Capitol Police would do is recognize the danger much earlier than they did. And yet I think, you know, 14 days later, everyone's aware that this is quite a real threat. You know, in some places, they simply didn't have the legislature show up or wasn't supposed to meet in the first place. And obviously it's, you know, you can protest an empty building, but it's not quite the same.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 22nd, 2021. It was supposed to be the big sequel to the Stop the Steal rally-turned-riot of January 6th. It was supposed to be the largest armed protest in the history of the United States in all capitals of all 50 states. And yet Inauguration Day turned out to be peaceful. Protesters were few, acts of violence were even fewer. It's a major counterterrorism success, and like many major counterterrorism successes, it has largely been unremarked upon. How did we go without the sequel to the bloody events of January 6th? To what extent should we credit law enforcement action, the deplatforming of the president and his followers? Or is the explanation something entirely different? I asked Lawfare's foreign policy editor, counterterrorism expert Dan Byman, into the virtual jungle studio to talk it through. He identified six major factors that likely contributed to this week's success, and we talked about them all in sequence. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 22nd. Dan Byman, on the sequel that never came to be. So, Dan, we were expecting, or at least we were promised, in the negative sense, a major descent on Washington by the same people who brought us January 6th, and the largest armed protest in world history in 50 state capitals, none of which appears to have materialized. What happened?
So this is something I've thought a lot about. There was a real question after January 6th, which is, was this going to be basically a harbinger of a storm to come, in the words of many of the people involved, or something that was kind of an aberration? And I think a mix of the fallout from January 6th and the very proactive steps taken by government made a big difference. I'm going to give you kind of a long answer on, in my view, you know, about five or six things that I think really made a difference. One is that after the violence on January 6th, it was pretty widely condemned. And it wasn't just, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post and Lawfare saying, hey, this is a bad thing. It was a lot of voices on the Republican side condemning this. And this grew in the days after the attack. So, you know, right after the attack, you had almost a majority, about 45% of Republicans polled saying, you know, this was appropriate, right? The election was stolen and storming the Capitol is a good thing. But we see that number decline over time. So we see a changing public reaction as the reality of the violence sets in and as many Republican elites start to condemn it. A second thing is that we start to see a lot of arrests. So the count I have from the great Seamus Hughes at George Washington is, as we're recording, we have about 122 arrests related to the Capitol riots. That's, you know, not a huge number when you consider the whole anti-government and white supremacist universe. But if you think of going after the most active members, that starts to add up. You start to have some people who might have otherwise used violence who are taken down. But I think far more important is that it's sending a broader message. You start to see a number of groups, a number of individuals say, don't act. They're waiting to pounce, right? We're not going to use violence. We oppose violence because we know we'll be arrested if we use violence. So you start to see a deterrence from law enforcement, which is, of course, what you hope. And in a way, the depressing and amazing thing is that they didn't feel this way before January 6th, but now they finally realize that that violence has consequences. A third thing, which I think anyone who has seen pictures of Washington, D.C. will understand, is that a lot of key targets were protected. So in Washington, you had 20,000 guardsmen called out, more than are in Iraq and Afghanistan and places like that. I mean, it's a really staggering number. You had fencing put up, you have a large perimeter, and you see measures around the country where different state legislatures and are stepping up surveillance, they're stepping up perimeters, they're canceling sessions, they're doing things to make the targets harder to hit. And, you know, by itself, that doesn't solve anything, but taken together with other measures, it's very, very effective. A fourth factor I would name is that Trump himself appears to have kind of given up. His last few days were more a whimper than a bang. He, you know, said some of the right things in the most grudging way possible in terms of condemning violence. He didn't continue his calls to overthrow the results of the election. And, you know, this is a movement that had a leader. And that leader is, if not, you know, giving up completely, is certainly less active than he was a couple of weeks ago. And related to that is deplatforming. So we saw Trump, but also a number of other figures who were taken off major social media platforms. And we can talk all we want about regrouping on these minor ones or Parler coming up on with Russian support. But all that said, when they have less ability to communicate, it's harder to whip up violence. If they're more afraid of monitoring on those platforms, they're going to be less aggressive in what they call for. And we see real change. We saw that when they go after QAnon. We saw that when they took down politicians. And so I think that the platforming made a difference. And the last thing I'll say is that the kind of true crazy world of QAnon, obviously, it's still functioning, but, you know, there was a bit of implosion, right? They're still waiting for the, you know, President Trump to announce that he's declaring martial law and arresting, you know, millions of Americans who were part of a vast child pornography ring, right? And at some point, this didn't happen, right? And, you know, with these prophetic movements, you can always go on to the next one, but there is at least some noise within the movement that maybe this isn't quite true. Right. And I don't want to overstate that because it's very hard to predict these conspiratorial movements. But I think that's a factor as well.
So that was so well organized that let's just use that as an outline and tick through those things individually and discuss them. So the first is condemnation and the fact that it actually didn't play well. This will come as a bit of a surprise to a lot of people who have been viewing this from the center and the left and who have spent the last few weeks outraged that there hasn't been more condemnation. Walk us through in what sense, if you were a participant in the January 6th violence, you would feel that the reaction was not that for which you were hoping.
So let's put yourself, if you will, in the shoes of someone who's not a crazy QAnon conspiracist, but rather someone who wrongly but genuinely believes this election was stolen and they're outraged. And you would expect, because the people you're talking to in your Facebook group, your social connections, they all kind of feel the same way, which is how we are as a society. And so you were expecting that you would be seen as kind of a hero. And, you know, in the eyes of some people, you clearly were. It's not that there was universal condemnation. But you had a lot of people say, okay, we've gone too far, who looked at the violence in the Capitol, who looked at the destruction and said, this is too much. You had figures who, you know, the kind of Mitch McConnells of the world, who were very willing to tolerate Trump even though they were not Trumpy, kind of pure Trump supporters, who were openly willing to condemn him. And you had the immediate switch of, places like the Wall Street Journal that, at times have been favorable towards Trump's policies condemning him. So you had a lot of, I'll say, not just mainstream Republicans, but conservative Republicans condemning this sort of violence rather than embracing it or excusing it and so on. So again, it wasn't universal condemnation, but you were hoping that, the bold deeds of a few men would inspire a nation. And instead, it seemed to inspire the nation to condemn these bold men.
But you could also look at it if you were that group of people and say, hey, even after what happened, the majority of House Republicans, a solid majority of House Republicans, voted to, support our position, if not our actions, with respect to the counting of electoral votes. The majority of House Republicans did not vote to impeach the president. And even some of the senators, only a few senators backed down, seven or so supported, if not the specific things that we did, the basic position that we were taking. Why would you see the coalition as having been weakened rather than tested and largely held together?
So the people who voted, who opposed the results of the election, they had committed themselves beforehand. And they're still understandably afraid of President Trump and his supporters in the primary. So there are electoral reasons, and these people were mostly on record in advance of the violence. But certainly the violence, you didn't have new people joining them. And I would add that, in the Senate, especially where people are able to take a slightly longer time horizon, you have a real possibility of people voting to convict on impeachment. I'm not sure I would say a likelihood, but if I were President Trump, I'd be very uneasy about this. And as you know far better than I, Ben, a year ago, this was completely out of the question, right? There was, rock solid Republican opposition to this. We just knew this wasn't going to happen. And but now you have, a true fracturing in this, and you have a large number of people speaking out who didn't speak out before. I tend to look at someone like, Marco Rubio as a weather vane, right, where he's always trying to kind of balance both sides, and he's condemning things, right? So if you have, it's not as if it's only someone courageous like Mitt Romney doing this, right? It tends to be people who are, more willing to try to court both sides of this.
All right, so let's talk about law enforcement action. And you, I think, quite rightly divide law enforcement action into the disruption component of the arrests, but also the deterrent function of the arrests. I want you to talk a little bit more about that. To what extent is the average person who was thinking of turning out, dissuaded from doing so because their leader has been arrested, or one of their many leaders has been arrested, or because they are actually thinking about violent action, and they have seen now that law enforcement will take that very seriously?
So it's a bit hard to tease that out. And I'll be honest, I don't have the data to kind of do this properly at this point. So I'm really speculating. One thing about this movement, if you want to call it that, is it's very decentralized. So, we could talk about the Proud Boys, or we could talk about, the 3%ers or any of these groups, but it's not as if there's a kind of national organization with one leader at the apex that's motivating, tens of thousands of people. This is lots of small groups, many self-proclaimed or locally organized, coordinating their activities. So many of the people who have been arrested are kind of more important members of that node or more visible. But it's not as if, this is a top-down organization like, the Lebanese Hezbollah, where the leader is dictating something and so on. But that said, you do have some disruption, right? Each of these people is motivating, 20 people. That's a significant number if you go after 100. In addition, and I would say probably even more so, is the deterrence function, right? People are realizing that the conspiracy charge is a pretty big one, and they're pretty vulnerable to it. I think they're also starting to recognize that, they may be vulnerable to charges, whether it's weapons charges or property damage charges, that there are a lot of low-level things that can really add up if they're not careful. And as they start to see people quite visibly arrested all around the country, and you know, here the paranoia actually works in the favor of the government, that people are going to start to, you know, panic. They're going to assume the government capability is often more than it is. But I will also add, you know, these people enjoyed years of impunity where they were able to do things that more traditional violent radicals that we focused on, like jihadists, were simply not able to do. So they could much more openly incite and organize on social media. They were allowed to carry weapons with much less disruption and so on. And if the U.S. government starts to kind of apply the law aggressively in a way it did to go after jihadists, these people, you know, are going to suffer tremendously. And, you know, probably the biggest example of this is how many of them kind of carry their cell phones with them and were transmitting their location, and with that, their guilt, while they were storming the Capitol, right? That's just kind of, you know, operational security 101 that almost all of them violated.
So all of that is a very good argument, if you're one of these people, for not showing up and storming a state capitol or try to breach the lines that the National Guard established. But it is not a particularly good argument for not having the largest armed peaceful protest in the history of the country, right? Because in a lot of state capitals, that's legal, right? And certainly the protest, the peaceful protest with, you know, very big weapons is to some degree a constitutionally protected right. This did not simply seem to disrupt or deter the violent illegal actions. It actually seemed to deter the event from taking place at all. And I'm wondering if you think that's because in a typical First Amendment law sense, this created a chilling effect on speech. We can debate whether that's the worst thing in the world in this context, but it's certainly something that, you know, First Amendment law really warns against, right? Or whether it's that the nature of the protests being contemplated were so inherently violent that to deter one is also to deter the other?
That's a good question. And again, let me plead a bit of ignorance in terms of, you know, data, because you could actually do real social science research on this and come up with an answer as opposed to the speculation I'm about to give. So I would say, yes, I suspect there was some degree of a chilling effect, right? That, you know, if you look at the protests on the Mall before the assault on the Capitol, they were pretty rowdy. There was a lot of nasty rhetoric and violent rhetoric. You know, you see, you know, a noose being displayed, for example. And so the line between, you know, where this is peaceful protest and where it's a violent mob is kind of blurring from the start. And so I think people were saying, you know, maybe I don't want to show up with my noose or with my guns, even if I intended to do so without storming a Capitol. So I think there was some degree of, I would use the word deterrence, and I'm not a lawyer, but chilling does seem to take place as well.
Let's talk about protection, your third point. So yeah, I understand that having tens of thousands of National Guard in Washington sealing off a whole area would operate as a deterrent if you were thinking of storming that area. And I also understand that the heightened state of security in Washington would probably deter people from trying to come into town to do anything at all. But I'm not sure I see how that deters action in 50 state capitals, a lot of which don't have, none of which have federal level security. And so I'm interested in your sense of the state capitals as having been well protected too. What do we know about state level preparations and about how effective they were?
So this was the biggest surprise to me. When people asked me my concerns before Inauguration Day, I said, I feel pretty confident in the protections that in Washington, D.C., but I'm much more concerned about the state level. And this was a good news story, right? The concerns didn't play out. So I would say, you know, one, in a few places we did see, you know, pretty serious security presence. And we also saw more basic defensive measures that I wish we had seen on January 6th, right? So we saw the perimeter pushed out in lots of places and just more fencing and efforts to control crowds. I think also there was a sense among the, you know, existing police that this was much more serious, right? I mean, one of the things that if we could go back in time, I think the Capitol Police would do is recognize the danger much earlier than they did. And yet, I think, you know, 14 days later, everyone's aware that this is quite a real threat. You know, in some places, they simply didn't have the legislature show up, or it wasn't supposed to meet in the first place. And obviously, it's, you know, you can protest an empty building, but it's not quite the same. And, you know, of course, the inauguration's happening in Washington, D.C., not at the state level. So there's less reason to show up at the state level. These are all possibilities, but I'm not 100% sure which ones dominate. And I was worried that, you know, even 5 or 10 violent people might show up at some state capitol and make some noise in a very unpleasant way. And that didn't happen.
All right, let's talk about item number 4, which is Donald Trump. I agree with you that his relative quiet and relative good behavior, and I emphasize the word relative on the latter point, probably had an effect. I'm interested in your thoughts about whether it is a but-for cause effect. As in, imagine he either had his Twitter account or decided to be loud, goes on Fox News and says, "We still think the election was stolen. The election was, you know, everybody knows it. You know, we have one last chance to stop the steal." Is the whole day different?
In my view, yes. I do think all the other factors we've been talking about would matter and would diminish the danger. And I would especially stress the law enforcement being on alert would really help. But you know, the president of the United States, as he is more than happy to remind you, got over 70 million votes, right? He has a lot of people who support him and a lot of people who believe this was a stolen election. And so I do think if he were aggressively pushing a narrative and a call to action, many of his followers would support it.
So that actually suggests that another thing was effective here, which is the impeachment vote, right? Because I think one reason Donald Trump was on best behavior the last few days, other than throwing a party for himself at Andrews Air Force Base, is that there is a pending Senate impeachment trial. And so is it fair to say that the House of Representatives, including 10 Republicans in the House of Representatives, by voting to impeach him, created a bit of a deterrent on his behavior that in fact operates probably speculatively to deter the behavior of others?
So here I'd frankly defer to your knowledge and others, but my instinct is yes, that he was very aware of this. And also, I suspect some of his lawyers may have told him that there is a little criminal risk from his behavior on the 6th. So he's vulnerable for future actions, and you don't want to exacerbate the past ones and make people likely to kind of bring that up. So I do think that reality of kind of personal risk to him is real. And certainly I suspect his advisors felt it as well, as, you know, they may be less responsible for the violence, but they're obviously people who are easier to target than the president of the United States himself.
All right. This brings us to Twitter. One reason the president is so quiet is that he doesn't have his Twitter feed. And a lot of other people don't have their Twitter feeds either. And Parler basically doesn't exist for the relevant period. And a whole lot of social media accounts are disappearing. Maybe this is the biggest explanatory factor, that it just prevents word from getting out, prevents a certain amount of organization. And if you combine it with law enforcement action, it's actually the degree of disruption is pretty big.
I think so. And it's remarkable. And I'll say Twitter, you know, I think Facebook played a tremendous role from the group's point of views, because a lot of them have a presence on these different kind of private Facebook groups. And so I think, you know, the broader social media effort against them really did matter. And what's amazing to me about the president, and again, I'd welcome you, your thoughts on this, is he seems to have a hard time communicating without Twitter. Right, that it's really just how he thinks about engaging with the world, right? He'll watch television and share his thoughts with everyone. And, you know, the idea that he would do a press release that genuinely reflected his feelings seems almost inconceivable, right? That he would have said, you know, oh, I'm the president of the United States. I have all these other tools for communicating with the world. You know, I wouldn't have thought that one social media platform's actions could have such a silencing effect, but he relied on it so much to be his way of conveying his very visceral feelings about, you know, it could be an issue like the elections, but it could also be his, you know, feelings about The Apprentice, right? And I don't think, you know, a television interview kind of serves the same purpose for him and isn't as spontaneous, right? Obviously, he, you know, in live speeches and on interviews, he is, will go off on his own and kind of ramble and say things, but there is quite nothing like watching his Twitter feed while he's watching television to get a sense of what's obsessing the man.
And yet, I mean, look, at one level, you're absolutely right. The pure, unfiltered Donald Trump comes through in exactly two communicative settings. One is Twitter, and the other is the rally, where his only interlocutor is the crowd, and he doesn't have a pesky reporter asking him challenging questions. He has a fawning crowd responding to his foibles. But I do think if he had walked into the White House press room and basically given a Twitter-like reaction in real time, Fox News would have carried it live. OANN would have carried it live. Does it not serve the same purpose as Twitter for this purpose?
It certainly could, but I don't think he's ever really done that, right? It would be a different way of doing things in his last few days and something that I just don't think he's as comfortable with, right? I mean, I'm just trying to imagine him actually in a press conference setting responding to the news of the day in the same way. And you're right, it's more likely if he's before a big rally. But before a big rally, he doesn't have the visual stimulation in front of him, right? He has the crowd. So he'll talk about kind of what's on his mind. But what's really amazing is when he's watching current events and shares his immediate unfiltered impressions with everyone around him. And, you know, Twitter enables him to kind of both watch and consume the news and then comment and make the news at the same time. And so I think it's really unusual. But you might be right. There's a lot of possibility here for, you know, different ways this might have gone in terms of his communication. And I do think he was, you know, deterred a bit by some of the consequences. But I also think he had one strong way of doing things, and being deprived of that really mattered.
Finally, you mentioned the QAnon implosion, which is ongoing as we speak and maybe a little bit too early to address substantively. But what do we know about the fractures within Q and among its most ardent supporters? And what can we say at this stage about the degree to which this played any meaningful role here?
So as you said, this is very much in the watch this space mode. You know, a lot of the Q world was, you know, keyed around the idea of Trump as a savior who was going to bring, you know, justice to the world's enemies and had a secret campaign to do so. And at some point, you know, it's supposed to happen, right? And as the days are ticking towards the end, you're expecting it to happen at any moment if you're a fervent believer, and it simply didn't. Now, you know, right now what I have are anecdotes, right? And this is a stunningly vast group of people, and some of whom believe some aspects and some of whom believe others, and there are different interpreters of Q. It's a bizarre world that I certainly don't fully understand. And I do think, you know, that there already are divisions and splinters, and we'll see further ones now that, you know, Trump himself is no longer their fixation. There'll be a group of people who continue to believe in Trump. There'll be others who will move on to a new plan in their eyes by some other figure. There'll be questions on whether a Biden administration will more aggressively go after this as opposed to kind of quasi-endorse it as Trump did from time to time. So there are a lot of inflection points, I think, ahead for the movement. But it's really remarkable how many people got sucked into this void. And, you know, I don't know what QAnon will look like in 2 years, but I suspect there'll be, you know, vast internet-based conspiracy movements that are truly international. You know, one thing that I only learned recently was just how vast the Q phenomena was in Japan, right? And so I can imagine other movements either arising concerning the United States or other countries that somehow become global.
I'm rooting for the lizard people conspiracy theory myself. I think it's way more fun than Q.
They've gotten a free ride for too long, I would agree.
I think, you know, I changed my Twitter icon to a lizard person today. I think we should just go with the lizard people. So I want to close with a very complicated question, which is sometimes in counterterrorism, when you have a success, you can attribute it to very specific things. A particular plot was disrupted. For example, the plot to kidnap and perhaps kill the governor of Michigan, right? And this is something that was an advanced enough plot that you're quite sure that absent your intervention, it is actually going to happen. It doesn't happen because you arrest a bunch of people, right? So there you have a clear thing. But when you beat terrorist movements, when they make big plans and then there's no spectacular event that stops them, just a complex mix of things like this, and you identified six discrete and interacting features that play some role in, you believe, in the events that didn't happen this week. But how do you infer from that what the strategic value of any one of them is, or what lessons we should take for the future from the success of this week relative to, say, the first week of January?
So, you know, as a researcher on these issues, you know, what you look for is variation, right? Are there times when we've done similar arrest campaigns, but we haven't had the widespread condemnation, so you can sort out which factors mattered the most? You'd want to talk to some of the people involved, both those who were most likely to use violence, but also some of the people who might have been on the fence, and see how their attitudes changed. You would want to get a sense, when you talk about President Trump, of how his incitement in the past has changed crowd size and changed crowd action. So you're putting together lots of different pieces with fragmentary data. It's always hard when you get to interactions, because, you know, these particular factors haven't interacted in the same way in the past, right? But that's how you'd want to do it. Something I would stress that makes this hard is when you have a movement like the MAGA movement, and it is affected by a wide range of factors, some of the people will just drop out. But some will may leave the movement but go on to other movements. And you have to ask yourself, you know, what is success, right? So if someone is, you know, mobilized by Trump and a big Trump supporter and, you know, supported attacking the Capitol, but then they go off to the lizard people realm, right? They're not in the overthrow of the Capitol realm, right? Which is a good thing. But how do we feel about that, right? How do we feel about people moving from one radical cause to another? And that's one of the things that was quite remarkable about the Capitol riots, were the kind of large numbers of very different extremist groups who showed up at the same place. And I think that's a real space to watch as well, is to see not just the counterterrorism reaction, but how will these different fragments of the movement interact with one another? Are they still going to cooperate? Will they go off to their different hidey holes within the internet? I don't know, but that's definitely something we all need to pay attention to.
We're going to leave it there. Dan Byman, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode was Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our merch, which you have been dilatory in ordering, is available at thelawfarestore.com. You should do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. If you have not been banned from Twitter, you should tweet about us. Assuming Facebook has not suspended your account, you should share us on Facebook if you are still allowed to pin things on Pinterest. Please pin the Lawfare Podcast. And of course, assuming the Chinese Communist Party will let you do it, you should make a TikTok video about the Lawfare Podcast if, in fact, you have downloaded TikTok, which I most sincerely hope you have not. Our music is, as always, performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA.
TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.